boo doo doo doo. Ba da 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 da. Ba da be bo. Ba dee boo doo dee dee da. Shoo bee bee.
Welcome to iPodius, a special 12-episode podcast mini-series from MaximumFun.org in which I, John, of the Judge John Hotchman podcast, watch I, Claudius, the famous 1976 BBC miniseries about ancient Rome, for the time.
And you, I, Ellie Kalin, of the Flophouse podcast, watch it for the very first time, and then we're going to talk about it.
That's
and
right.
We've been talking about it.
We've been talking about it. We're going to be talking about it more, and then we're going to stop talking about it because we are near the end. Mm-hmm. This week we are discussing the penultimate episode of I, Claudius, episode XI or 11 in Wikipedia numbers, A God in Colchester. On this episode of I, Claudius, we'll hear more from super producer Jordan Cowling and her mom Avis, plus a very special guest dispatch from the Empire from the one and only incredible actor, a community member, and I, Claudius fan, Gillian Jacobs. You do not want to miss it, so do stay tuned. Elliot, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm sad to see that our I, Claudius, I, Podius audio journey is coming to a close very swiftly, but
not,
I'm also...
Not me. No, I'm not sad.
No, but at the same time, I am... I'm somewhat exhausted of the... As I think we were talking about last episode, the continued degradation of Rome and our friend Claudius. But I think things are looking up in this episode.
Turns things around. I'll tell you what, as we come into the final episodes, I will say this. I've been really enjoying sharing this with you. I've always enjoyed speaking to you, and I will miss having a conversation, and we should find other excuses. Oh, that's right. I forgot we're going to do our 800 episode recap of Zed Cars.
Oh,
the British police,
looking
forward to it. Police serial drama in which almost all of these actors appeared at one point or another. But we are now in a grim part of I, Claudius, the end game, and I have zero memory of what happens in the final episode,
mm-hmm.
and I do not. Whereas I have lots of memories of what happened in the earlier episodes, especially the first three or four or five of them. I mean, I just have a lot of emotional affection for them. But this one, now it's getting a little hard to watch, and you know, we've been plowing through them. So I'm looking forward to the fall of Rome, but I have enjoyed this experience a tremendous amount. But let's go back for a second and just recap where we are.
You got it.
When we last left the Empire in Common Era 43, Claudius dropped the mic a couple of times and became emperor and was like, I'm going to be the best emperor of all time. And he passed down his first, and that's kind of true, right? I mean, Augustus was pretty good in getting
It's hard because any emperor of Rome inevitably had a certain amount of killing their enemies and doing things that we would find terrible today.
Right.
Like they all ruled over an empire that involved slavery and things like that. But along the line, I mean, considering his competitors up to this point have been Augustus, Tiberius, and Caligula, I can say, yeah, that he's aimed for that target of best Roman emperor
ever. Yeah,
there's
only questionable honor among emperors. But after saying that he did not want to become emperor, he dares the Senate to make him emperor, and they do. And he passes down his first death sentence on Roman Spock, which I realize now I should have just said Romulan. Because that's what a Roman Spock is in the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm.
His young wife Messalina made a whole mess of things, arranging for her mother to marry.
Lived up to her name.
That's exactly right. They should have called her Mess It Uppa. Stupid.
That was the most dad jokest of dad jokes, I think, in this whole series.
Offer me the dagger, Elliot. I'm going to take my own life.
It's the honorable thing to
thank
do.
Thank you. All right. Oh, it's just rubber. Never mind. Anyway, so she's much younger than Claudius, and she initially seemed like a nice match for him, but it turns out she has boundless appetites for hugging and kissing men, A, and we'll learn more about that in this episode, and B, embodies a rather depressing and misogynistic portrait of a conniving schemer, as we discussed last time. And her first number one scheme last episode was to get Appius Silanus, her childhood crush, to marry her mom so that she herself, Messedupa, could get busy. She could get her busy little mind busy with him. But Solanus turned out to be a prude and an anti-monarch and a pro-republic person. And the fact that the emperor's wife wants to hug and kiss him just proved to Solanus that Claudius is somehow just as bad as Caligula. All emperors are bad. Both parties are terrible. Vote for Gary Johnson. And and therefore he decides he's gonna kill Claudius.
Meanwhile, it was the ancient Roman equivalent to voting for Gary Johnson, assassinating the only good emperor there's been so far.
Exactly so. Well, they're all terrible. meanwhile, Herod Agrippa, before he leaves to return to the East, who is Claudius's oldest friend and the king of the Jews, tells Claudius, "Trust no one, no one." And sure enough, Claudius can't trust anyone, not even his secretaries, Pallas and Narcissus, that delightful comic duo. Because it turns out they attempted to fix the price of corn, probably the most exciting price fixing of corn episode in the entire series, I have to say.
I have to imagine George Lucas watching this as a young man.
Yes.
And he sees that scene and he's like, this is what Star Wars is missing. This screenplay I'm working on of Star Wars, it's missing talk about corn prices.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I don't think we talked about it in the last episode, but I remember I made a note. It's like, this is about as thrilling as the opening crawl of The Phantom Menace talking about the Senate's reduction of trade routes and taxation. Really, really grim process stuff. But it does allow Claudius to shine because it shows that he is the kind of emperor who's going to dig in and solve problems and save the empire money and get things done. But mm-hmm. even though he's so good at that, Appius Solanus is like, all emperors are bad. He's the worst. And also, Messalina told me that he's a creep and a depraved perv. So I'm going to stab him right now. But luckily, Claudius has incredibly strong arms, as we hear over and over again. And he shields the rubber knife with his strong arm and evades assassination. Even though Claudius once believed in the Republic and still ostensibly does, at the end, to preserve his office, he sentences Solanus to death. And Fuzzy in the foreground, blinded by love, he sits there, increasingly susceptible to power, while crystal clear in the background, in one of the rare cinematic moments of this otherwise staged play, Messalina scowls at him and plans new things to mess up. Mm-hmm. But even though things are pretty bad, at least Claudius has a new doctor from Greece who has given him permission to fart more.
And that's all we're looking for from every doctor,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that doctor does not show up in this episode. I think we had some question last time about whether he would show up again.
Yeah.
So not in this episode. Maybe Dr. Xenophon Fartmore, which is his full title, will show up in the next episode. But for now, we are in episode XI, Common Era 47 to 48, A God in Colchester. Mm-hmm. We have a very, very, very brief old man Claudius pancake makeup sequence. It lasts about 30 seconds where Claudius...
He's just thinking, right? He's just thinking.
Just staring into the middle distance before we get right to it with some adulterous hugging and kissing between Messalina and the actor Minister. This is a new character. How would you describe him?
He is he's an actor and he acts like an actor. He's got the big... laughing, bold personality of actors from ancient Roman times until today.
Yeah, and he's all scratched up on his back because Messalina is a very passionate and sharp-nailed lover.
Yeah,
and
this is something that you see in the movies and on TV a little bit, quite a lot, and yet I think I've only ever heard of in rumors the lover so passionate that they literally destroy your back. With their claws.
Yes. Well, you have to be dating a werewolf.
That's the secret. I get you.
So Minister is one of her regular lovers. She apparently is taking lovers all the time. But he is also someone who understands her and says to her, you are a bored person. And she said, I guess I am bored. I should have been an actor or a sculptor or a podcaster because at least they have their art. It's weird how she talked about podcasting in this.
I mean, the show is ahead of its time, just as ancient Rome was.
When I make love, I reach for something that men never dream of.
Oh, what's that?
I don't know. but it's there. Always just out of reach.
By the way, this is a good time to remind people that iClaudius... iClaudius deals with a lot of adult themes, including sex, manipulation, and assault. It is not for kids, and therefore, this is your content warning. Kids, get the F out of here. Mm-hmm. In fact, in this very scene, we see a whole lot of Meneaster butt in a moment. But before he turns over and we see his naked actor butt, he has this idea. Here's something that's fun for you. You think you're the best at hugging and kissing. Let's challenge the Guild of Prostitutes to a sex championship. One night only. You, the wife of the emperor, versus an incredibly prolific local legendary prostitute, a Sicilian named Scylla. Quoth Meneaster, copulation on a cosmic scale to set the universe ringing with the cheers of gods. Which is a very poetic way of saying Fuckfest Volume 2.
Yeah, well, it's as if Stan Lee was narrating some kind of epic gangbang. It would be like, copulation on a cosmic scale to set the gods themselves applauding. Well, it seems the silver sex surfer has reached the atmosphere of Earth. You know, like, I was just reading with my son.
I don't like to hear you talking that way, Elliot.
I just was reading the... rereading with my son the Galactus trilogy from the old Fantastic Four issues, and so much of it is just Stan Lee's bombastic prose about what a cosmic, unimaginable threat Galactus is and how powerful the Silver Surfer is. And so hearing him talk about copulation on a cosmic scale, I was like, oh, yeah, that's pure Stan Lee talk. It can't get any bigger.
And Messalina thinks this is a fine idea. Bring on your Sicilian, she says, and they laugh and laugh, and then he turns over and we see his butt. Cut to inner cardboard chamber.
Before we move on, I just want to say, so the things that Messalina does in this and has done to her in this, it's all stuff with in theory, historical basis. Like, this competition was something that she supposedly did. Now, all the histories about Messalina that we have were written decades and decades after she died. And so, again, there's no way of knowing how true it is or how much of it was written by her enemies after death, or enemies of the Julio-Claudian imperial line, which she was a part of. But this is all stuff that was that there's some reporting of, at least. And it was only in researching this that I realized how much art has been made about Messalina's story.
Oh.
That for a while, the sex competition and her eventual death were the popular subjects for statues and paintings.
Yeah, why didn't Wilfred Josephs write an opera about this? Call it the Fuckfest Part 2.
I mean, part surely would be repetitive. There's only, you know, it's kind of the same thing over and over again.
Well, I'm making reference to the orgy scene from what was it, last episode?
Oh, it was two episodes ago, because it was when Caligula was still emperor, right?
Yeah, that was a true fuckfest. This is a sex contest.
Yes.
And the terms of the contest is how many men, presumably, can Messalina have intercourse with in the span of 24 hours before she gives up, or who will give up first,
who's going to be exhausted first?
Yeah, who will be exhausted first, her or this famous local prostitute, Scylla?
And it's funny that, so the show has been very open about, you know, the sexual decadence of the Imperials and stuff like that. But it's not until that they're like, oh yeah, the Guild of Prostitutes has this famous prostitute, that it's like, oh, I guess they did see sex differently back in ancient Rome. It was that the things they were horrified were often that it was like, that the emperor's wife was doing these things, not necessarily that someone was doing these things.
Yeah, that's true. And later on, you know, Messalina will allude to the fact that she knows that even though Claudius is still totally smitten with her and cannot see any of the obvious power maneuverings that she's undertaking, any of the obvious adultery that she is undertaking, any of the obvious sex competitions she's undertaking, because he loves her so much, he still has a side piece. He's still seeing Calpurnia on the side. And she's like, I know, and I don't care. It's healthy for you.
Yeah.
So obviously attitudes towards sex were different at this time. I mean, and it's also, we're led to believe that in this.
It is Rome, which means it's Italy. So as Claudius is well aware, Friday night you're out with the Gumar. Saturday night you're out with your wife. That's just the rules. That's just ancient Rome rules.
What is that?
Well, that's from, you know, mafia stuff, like Goodfellas and things like that.
Mafia stuff. Okay.
Yeah. You got the knight for your wife and the knight for your mistress.
Great. That's right. Good. Good, good anti-Italian-American stereotyping. Thanks a lot.
Sorry.
You know that my great-grandparents, is that right? Yeah, my great-grandparents on my father's side, my father's mother's side, immigrated from Udine, Italy, which is in northern Italy, which is to say, basically, Slavs. But I am Italian American, and I take great offense to that.
I apologize. Not really. Most of my knowledge of Italian Americans comes only from the movies and growing up in New Jersey. So it's a biased account. Is what I'm saying.
Just like we can't be sure. This is a biased account, perhaps, of Messalina as well.
And when that moment when she gives that speech about the thing that she's reaching for, it's like her character kind of gets short shrift in the series. She is, for the most part, just a bad news bear all around.
Yeah.
But even she gets that moment of like, no, I have some kind of inner life that is looking for something. And I don't know if it is an attempt to kind of like sympathize with the idea of nymphomania, that this is a compulsion that she has, or just to show that like even she's capable of deeper things. She's not just a schemer, you know?
Yeah.
But that moment was very surprising
to me. Yeah, that's why I brought it up.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wanted to highlight a little more.
But now you can talk about it.
Well, I just did. I'm done.
Yeah. I think we covered it. She's got an inner life. I get it. She's got an inner life, and you think all Italian Americans are in the mafia.
I mean, not all of them, just the ones I grew up around, I guess.
You know what? I value your life, so maybe you should stop talking about this.
Sorry.
What if the upshot of this podcast was for this one conversation you get rubbed out?
That would be terrible, but it would be very fitting with the show.
That would be a bad outcome. All right.
Listen, I think so.
If you're in organized crime or otherwise offended by Elliot's obvious incendiary anti-Italian American stereotyping, do me a favor. Don't murder him with your knives, you mafiosi.
I will settle for some very rude tweets pointing out what I've done so I can apologize.
Yeah, go get your shine box, Elliot. Let's move on. Cut to inner cardboard chamber at the palace. Claudius's office. Here come Pallas and Narcissa again, those wonderful two gossips and self-servers. They are tabulating the death count in Britain because Claudius has been, the reason that Messalina has been having so much sex with all these actors is Claudius has been out there kicking butt and retaking Britain for Rome. And now he's on his way home and they're debating, like, what are we going to tell him about his wife? How do we solve a problem called Messalina? How do we take a cloud and pin it down? a flippity a will-o'-the-wisp, a clown.
You really know that song.
One of my favorite. How do you hold a moonbeam in your hand? Anyway, they decide basically to kick the can down the road and not say anything. And now they literally decide
we'll talk more about this later.
Yeah, we'll talk more later. Yeah. This episode really moves along. As you pointed out last time, the first, like, 9 episodes cover the first book, I, Claudius. And now these last 4 episodes have to cover the entirety of the second book, Claudius the God, by Robert Graves.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as we get into the middle of this episode, it's really relying, I think, with all respect to Jack Pullman, who did an amazing job writing this, and Herbert Wise directing it, they're really relying on a lot of voiceover, like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this has happened. Like, dramatization takes a backseat to Claudius just going, like, and then Messalina took another lover, and they conspired against me, and then here I am now. Like, it's really, really cooking. Because I expected to see the sex competition much later in the episode, but here we are, right there, in the new palace. Minister, the actor, is entertaining the pre-sex comp crowd with lame limericks.
He's doing like orgy warm up. just to like get everyone in a laughing mood, like, hey, come on, we're supposed to be having fun. Let me do some of my Roman joke poetry.
Right.
You ask me how my farm can pay, since little it will bear. It pays me thus, 'tis far away, and you are never there.
But now, enter Scylla, the prostitute, played by, I wrote it down somewhere, stand by, Charlotte.
Charlotte Howard.
Charlotte Howard. We'll talk
was
more.
Was Charlotte Howard on Zed Cars? Yes, she was.
She played Angela in Zed Cars. I made a note of that as well.
And she was also on a, oh no, never mind. She was on a TV show called Fraud Squad once, which sounds like Claude Squad.
Sounds like Claude Squad.
But for, as, so for a moment, I thought it said Claude Squad. I'd be like, that would have been amazing.
That would have been an incredible coincidence. No. Charlotte Howard was actually, I think you obviously discovered this as well. I mean, she had a fairly robust television career in the 70s. But as far as I can tell, she is still with us, but has not worked in a long, long time. And a shame that, I say.
Yeah.
She's great in this. Like her, you know, Meneaster comes in and, you know, immediately starts baiting her with his smiley, little bit of a gleam in his eye, actor lasciviousness, and she just stares him down. He goes, my name's Meneaster, I'm an actor, most people have heard of me. My name's Scylla, I'm a whore, everyone's heard of me.
She's, it's like what Meneaster is struggling to do, she does so easily. She is just like throwing shade at a top level so casually.
The difference between you and me, actor, is you're a snob and I'm not. And the difference between this great lady and myself is that my work is her hobby. My hobby happens to be gardening, for which I don't expect to be paid.
Charlotte Howard has left behind a bag of 10,000 fucks because she has stopped giving them. Because she's had so many.
Yeah, she doesn't need
way,
anymore.
Yeah, she not only does she not give a fuck, but she very pointedly deserves, she very pointedly demands payment for the fucks that are about to happen in the sex competition. Obviously, though, we see a lot of things in this miniseries. And in particular, we see a lot of bare butts and tops in this particular episode, more than ever before, I felt. We do not obviously see the whole sex competition.
No, and I have to assume they were saving that for the other spinoff, Scylla, the improper prostitute, which would just be her going into different situations and showing up those rich people with her wit and her wiles.
But I am obviously rooting for Scylla in this one. Come on.
The minute she walks on screen, you're like, yeah, I'm on Team Scylla, for sure. Or Scylla, I should say.
What did you say, Scylla?
Scylla, by accident. Team Skrillex, yeah.
So we don't get to see the competition. Instead, someone yells, let the games begin, and they go into a different part of the new palace. We cut now back to the old palace. Palace, speaking of palace, the character palace.
We cut to palace in the palace.
Palace is at the palace. And he gets a word about the hug and kiss competition from a soldier named Justice. And palace, and Justice is like, we need to do something. And he's like, too bad for you, because you already told your boss about this thing, and he's Messalina's lover, and you're probably marked for death. Bye bye. I don't know what the point of that scene was, other than to say Palace is not standing up. He's not going to tell the Emperor until he absolutely has to.
Yeah, I think it's just reiterating. One, it was doing what we call gapping in drama, which is to put another scene in to fill up some time so that you can come back to the sex competition without having to actually see it. And just reiterating that Palace is intent on, not only he's not going to tell the Emperor about this, he doesn't want anybody else to tell the Emperor about this. This is, as long as he can keep this a secret from Claudius, he's going to do so.
Why doesn't he want to tell Claudius? I mean, that's the thing. What's his name? Narcissus, his buddy, is always like, we've got to tell the Emperor. And Palace is like, nope, we're not going to. And I don't understand why he's nervous about telling Claudius this. Claudius can't hear anything bad about Messalina, and Palace figures he'll get fired or killed?
I think that's mostly the reason, yeah. I think it's one of those things where, again, they're not used to Claudius was an emperor for a bunch of years by this point, but in the minds of Romans is still, oh, if you piss off the emperor, he's going to kill you. So if I tell him his wife is having a sex contest, he is going to get either not believe me and kill me, or he's going to be, why didn't anyone tell me about this before, and get mad and kill me. So best to keep – I'll just keep kicking that can along until Messalina manages to kill her husband, and then I won't have to deal with it anymore. La, 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 la. I think that's it.
As he says to Justice after revealing that he's probably been marked for death because he knows too much, Palace says, I will tell the emperor eventually. I have learned to tread very carefully in a burning building. cold. Ice runs through his veins. That's why he can hang out in burning buildings all the time.
The fire can't get close to him. It just freezes.
You're right. I didn't appreciate it. This whole scene, it was kind of dull, but of course they're just using it to mark time because we cut back immediately to the sex competition.
Because the only other thing you could have is old Claudia saying, yes, they copulated on a cosmic scale for many hours, but then eventually the contest came to an end. Like, that's one of the only other way to do it, basically. Or to have a clock wipe, which goes around the screen.
I really love how you captured Derek Jacobi's mournful voiceover that comes to haunt the rest of this whole episode. Because, I mean, it's all, he's now telling it from the point of view of, like, I know how I was fooled, and all of my dignity was taken from me, and I was deceived, and I was an idiot. And he just really flogs himself throughout the voiceover of the rest of this episode. It's really grim, and you captured it very well, Elliot. Well done. Oh,
thank you. Appreciate it.
You know what else you can do if you need to mark time in something?
Oh, what's that?
Just jump to the next thing. Take a break. Take a break for something else. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
iPodius, the podcast you're listening to, is brought to you by, of course, our Max Fun members. We owe everything to you, including the inspiration for this, but it's also brought to you by Acorn TV. Now, Acorn TV, it just makes sense that we would want to have them involved in this, and we're so happy that they are, because it's a great place to watch iClaudius, which is the show that I like to watch the most when I'm doing iPodius, because it's the show that iPodius is about. And if you haven't been watching it while listening, that seems like a missed opportunity. But what else do they have? Is this just an iClaudius delivery system, Acorn TV?
No. It's much more than that. From mystery to thrillers to comedy to drama, Acorn TV is your streaming destination for critically acclaimed series from Britain, Australia, Ireland, and beyond.
So you may be asking yourself, am I just going to be watching a bunch of TV shows from other countries where I don't know who the people are in them? The exact opposite. I think you're forgetting that all of your favorite actors are from other countries. Big stars like Sandra Oh.
Right, Canada. Canada.
Of course you have. Mm-hmm. Yep, Canada. Benedict Cumberbatch, who is from, Great Britain, England. And Olivia Colman, who comes from heaven. You can binge watch a classic series. You can binge watch a classic series like, Midsummer Murders, people love, or one of my mom's favorite shows, Doc Martin, or discover a new favorite. John, are there any new shows that you are particularly looking forward to?
Yeah, believe me, everyone. You know and love the actors that you find all over Acorn TV. Have you ever seen a Doctor Who? All of them are there, including David Tennant, the Ninth Doctor, everyone's favorite, starring in the brand new Acorn original mystery suspense series Deadwater Fell, which I'm really interested in seeing, on down to John Sim, who was the master, one of the masters, aside from Derek Jacobi, spoiler, on Doctor Who, with a three-part British miniseries combining gripping drama with a remarkable history of DNA fingerprinting called Code of a Killer. It's all kinds of great stuff. So, visit www.acorn.tv or download the Acorn TV app on your favorite device and use code PODIUS, P-O-D-I-U-S, for an extended 30-day free trial. That's acorn.tv, code PODIUS, Acorn TV, world-class TV from Britain and beyond.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a brand new podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
So, Elliot, you know, one of the ways that I was letting people know about the iPodius podcast was I was posting stuff on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, best way to do it, 21st century. Very in, very trendy. Yeah.
Mostly stealing pictures I have no rights to. Mostly of Patrick Stewart wearing a toupee, putting them on Instagram and telling people, go and watch this show so you'll know what we're talking about when iPodies finally comes out. And on one of the posts, I got a message from my old pal, the incredible actor. You know her from Love and Community and many, many other things. And she and I met, we worked together on an Apple commercial years and years and years and years and years ago. But that's ancient history. Probably the most important history of this civilization, but still ancient history. Her name is Gillian Jacobs, and she was a big I, Claudius fan. And I was just like, just send us a voicemail.
I was obsessed with I, Claudius as a child. My mother and I rented it from the library when I was in elementary school. And I got so into it that when the 4-H Club gave us eggs and we incubated and hatched these chicks, I named mine Posthumus Germanicus after a character in the miniseries. And I remember making an art project that was of Livia, his mother. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've watched it. But I was entranced by the miniseries in the third grade, which did not really win me any friends.
We're back. It's iPodius, and we marked some time, just enough time, for someone to win the sex competition. Is it Scylla, the plain-spoken professional, or Messalina, the amateur with a heart? The amateur with a heart of coal.
Sex? Oh, heart of coal. in any competition,
not heart of gold. I was trying to think of something to base, but yes, is it the prostitute with a heart of pragmatic aluminum, or is it Messalina, the amateur with a heart of sex?
And at this, you got to ask yourself on these things. Now I'm doing it like NFL game day or something. You got to ask yourself who wants it more. Now, Scylla, she's just in it for the money. She's a professional. She's going to do a good job. Messalina, she's got heart. She's got that thing you're looking for in your rookies when you're scouting. She's got soul. She really loves to play the game. So in this one, I got to put my money on Messalina. What do you think, Terry Bradshaw? I don't know. Scylla's got the skillas.
I don't care for this at all. They're too... Elliot Kalin has tried on two new looks in our now longstanding, at least almost decade and a half old friendship. One of which is him riffing as Stanley talking about the silver sex surfer, which grossed me out. And now he's doing NFL, phony NFL commentary, which is already really disturbing, but talking about a sex competition. I don't like this look on Elliot Kalin. I don't care for it.
Look, I'm trying out new things. It's late in the series. If we're gonna get a second season of I, Claudius, we got to start throwing some new elements out there. You know,
what if we pitched a sequel to I, Claudius? I guess that's what HBO's Rome is, right? I mean,
I don't know when Rome takes place, but I guess so. I mean, because I, Claudius ends before some more crazy stuff is about to happen. So there could be another one, but it would be about like after Claudius or something like that. I don't know. Or Claudius's ghost is just hanging over the future of Rome being like, oh, I wouldn't do that. Boy, that's bad.
Would it be called I Claudius? Roman numerals I Claudius?
It's the second one, yeah.
All right. We'll put a pin in that and come back to that later. But in the meantime, Scylla loses the sex competition. She can't take it anymore. She says Messalina's inhuman. Her insides must be made out of old army boots. But she
again, just a great line for Scylla. Just fantastic.
But she does get paid. And then we have this weird cut, like immediately cut to the famous statue of Romulus and Remus suckling from the wolf. What is the name of the wolf?
Capitoline Wolf. I don't know that she actually had a name.
Right.
I mean, wolves, to be fair, do not give themselves names.
That's
but
true.
But that statue is called the Capitoline Wolf.
Right. And the legend, of course, is that the twins Romulus and Remus suckled at the breast of a wolf, and Romulus became the founder of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And Remus...
Well, he went on to appear in Song of the South, which is unavailable now.
I was going to ask if you were going to say that. That's terrible.
Sorry.
You just... Look, this later on in this episode, we hear I think it's Pallas say, and maybe the first time that maybe it was the introduction of this into the lexicon, the term politically correct at the very last scene. And I made a note there. It's like, is this the first time someone said this politically correct? But one thing's for sure, Elliot Kalin in this episode is politically incorrect. You are really shocked with me today. I don't know either. It's very upsetting.
I apologize. I meant this is all stuff I meant to save for my SiriusXM show about iClaudius.
Yeah, Elliot Kalin off the chain. He's just saying what everyone else is thinking about iClaudius.
So Remus was killed by his brother Romulus. That's how what happened to him.
Oh, okay, good. Good brothers. Good brothers. Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean that statue has been there in the Senate cardboard set for every episode, every time you're in there. But this is this weird close up to go from I don't know what the thinking was there, but to go from the end of this sex competition to this image of two brothers suckling from the breast of a wolf. But it's a pretty, I don't know, what do you make of it? Anything?
It's both on the nose and also a little confusing.
Right.
Because I assume my big first assumption would be just that it is marking Messalina as a she-wolf, as this kind of insatiable, ravenous beast.
Yeah.
But
as she is referred to at the end of the last episode, that's right.
Oh, right, right.
She is referred to by Appius Silanus as a she-wolf. So, yeah, there you go. That's it. Thank you for making that connection. You're really, even though you're disturbing me with all of your political incorrectness, even though I'm a little bit of a snowflake right now, and I'm getting a little, you know what I mean?
You're bumping up against some things I'm saying, and I understand that.
Yeah, but at the same time, in the interpretive arts, you're killing it.
Oh, thanks. Now, the strange thing is that it cuts to that to symbolize that this for her when, as we all know from the last episode, she has given up breastfeeding her baby.
Another thing. Yeah, that's, I don't know. Look, Herbert Wise, I think by this episode is doing much more experimental shots. Many more,
yeah.
Much more experimental. You know what I'm saying. Herbert Wise is trying out some new stuff. Visually and cinematically in terms of his cutting from one thing to another, in terms of the shots that he sets up. It's much more experimental than the earlier episodes. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I that's probably, my guess would be that's a combination of both him wanting to communicate how much has changed since the beginning of the show, and also him wanting to like kind of jazz up that we're looking at a lot of the same sets and a lot of the same types of moments. Because he's also very particular about, and I assume it's him, maybe it's somebody else coming up with these, but like there are a lot of shots that are stagings that mirror the placement of people in earlier episodes. But I think it's partly stylistic for a reason, and also partly like we've been looking at these sets for a long time. Like we got to do some new things because the show's almost over.
Yeah, I'm bored out of my mind as the director. Let's try some new stuff. Well, speaking of echoes, Claudius, we pull back from the statue over the entryway to the Senate. The statue of the Capitoline Wolf and the Romulus and Remus. And then we get to the regular locked off shot of the Senate that we always see with the senators sitting on those dumb stairs on either side. And enter Claudius victorious from his conquest of Britain, flanked again by these two guys with these crazy horns and the and the wolf heads on their head. Did you see him this time?
No, this time I wasn't really paying close attention. I should have been looking out for them, but I just find...
How can you miss them?
It's so drawn to Claudius.
It's two guys wearing, it's two guys with like wolf heads on their heads playing primitive sousaphones. But to be fair to you, I missed them too. Because they actually showed up when Caligula entered. I'm not sure when I first noticed these guys, but I'm going to text you this image of them.
Okay.
Let's see, Elliot. And we'll put this online if Maximum Fun does not cancel this podcast.
Oh, yeah. How did I not notice those guys? Hold on. You're exactly right. Looking at it now, I don't know. I guess I was just drawn to the guy who's coming out to announce Claudius. But yeah, these guys look crazy.
Yeah. Well, they're back again in the Senate. They're going burp, 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 as Claudius comes back and receives the triumph for having brought Britain back into the fold of Rome for the first time in 108 years since the divine Julius, I guess, lost Rome as a province. Meanwhile, Claudius goes and sits down in his own seat in the Senate, and he's flanked by two guys with lion heads on their heads. It's getting wild. Like Herbert Wise at this point, like, look, these are the last episodes. I'm gonna blow everyone's mind with this close up on the Capitol and Wolf statue that everyone knows, but also, costume designer. Let's just put some wolf heads and lion heads in this.
just to mess with the squares. Come on, everybody. I was reading online, there was a website that was particularly focusing on the hair and costumes in the show.
Yeah.
And a lot of it they were saying they think was based on old sculptures and old from the time, like what people's hair and what their clothing would have been like. So I wonder if they found sculptures of like wolf head and lion head dudes. I don't know.
I don't know, but I need to look up the costume designer, because Barbara Kronig designed all the costumes, and for all of the appropriate sort of ha-haing we've been doing about the sort of low production value, the costumes are all pretty dope. I would say they all look great.
They look good, and they communicate different things about different characters, and especially she could have really easily just been like ancient Rome togas, toga, throw togas on people, but like there's a real eye towards how people of different classes and types dress differently, and like it really helps to separate who all these white people with sometimes curly hair, sometimes not, from each other.
Yeah, and everyone feels like they live in their outfits realistically. Do you know what I mean? None of it feels stagey. They all feel like, yeah, that's what people wore. Like, people just walked around with wolf heads on their heads.
Every now and then, yeah.
Well, I'm glad, Barbara Kronig, that Herbert Wise gave, in my fantasy, gave you leave at the end to just start mixing shit up.
The whole shoot, she was like, let me just put the lion heads and the wolf heads on. He was like, no. And then he was
darling,
like, you know
darling,
what?
Darling, wait until we're near the end. Let's just get this. I promise you the wolf's heads will come.
I'll tell you, let's shoot it both ways. We'll do it without the heads, and then we'll just go crazy, and we'll just put the heads on. And then they were watching the dailies, and he's like, no, yeah, the heads work. I shouldn't have said no.
Yeah. The head of BBC, Cornelius BBC, goes, I love those wolf's heads. Good job, Herbert. And Herbert Wise goes, should I give Barbara credit? And he's like, nah. Yeah, I thought that was good all along. I said to her, darling, you have to put those wolf's heads on. What a monster I've turned Herbert Wise into.
She stood in my way. Yeah, you don't know what a trial it was trying to get her to put wolf heads on people.
She was always saying no. All right, anyway, now we cut back. And now the reason I've hesitated moving on in this plot synopsis is that it's really just the story now is plot synopsis, right? It's just Claudius, old man pancake makeup Claudius, talking in voiceover, telling us rather than showing us what's going on. The first thing that he tells us about is that Marcus Vibius of Syria, guy we've never heard of, has some bad news. Herod Agrippa, Claudius's old pal, who's gone back to the east, is now fortifying the east against Rome. And Herod is assembling a new, you know, Herod was a Claude Squad member, but now he's assembling a new superhero team of local kings that he's going to lead against Rome, because Herod, much like Caligula thought before, Herod believes that he is the Messiah of Jewish prophecy, and that he is the one who is going to become the greatest god of all time.
And it throws a real relief on his, or throws into relief his advice to Claudius from the previous episode, trust no one, and he goes, even you? And you know now, like, oh yeah, it's because Herod was already thinking about how he's probably the Messiah and he's going to start a war against Rome and his best friend.
Right, exactly. So then enter Messalina, fresh from her sex competition. She's looking great.
Oh, wait. Oh, and there's one thing. Messalina enters and Claudius literally says to the person he's talking to, he says, we'll meet again later and talk some more. And I'm like, ah, you're turning into Augustus.
Yeah, well, he is turning into Augustus. He is unaware of what his own wife is doing. He's trying to do his best, but tons of information is being kept from him by his closest confidants, and he doesn't seem to mind, you know, that information. What he wants to know about is, what is my old friend Herod up to? Is he the Messiah or not? So he sends what's his name, Marcus Vibius, off to do some Messiah research. And Messalina comes in fresh from the sex competition, and she's like,
I never rested properly a single night thinking about you.
Wink, wink. Because she was having sex with other people that time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where she reveals that she knows that he's still meeting with Calpurnia, and she doesn't mind, but she might just sneak into his bed one of these nights. And he's like, ooh, so exciting. And the voiceover, mournful voiceover of Claudius goes, I was her slave, which is kind of a shitty thing to say if you're actually the emperor of a slave-owning society. Like, don't do that. There's real slaves.
It could have been a learning moment for him, but instead he fails to learn from that moment. And it's just casually mentioned along the way, I told you that guard Justice was plotting against you. So it's like, oh, okay. So that guard who was talking to Pallas earlier, off screen, he has been caught and killed.
Is that true? I missed that whole thing.
Yeah, I think she just says it. It's in my notes, at least. She just kind of offhandedly mentions it.
Right. And most of this is now just voiceover, as Claudius explains that Messalina wanted him to tell Meneaster the actor to do whatever she told him to do, specifically because she had been telling Meneaster to introduce her to her new romantic target, a consul named Gaius Silius. And Meneaster didn't want to be a matchmaker for Gaius Silius because Meneaster liked Gaius Silius's wife, but now he has to do it. And Messalina tells Silius that Claudius is worse than Tiberius, and now all of a sudden she has a new lover in the person of this consul, Gaius Silius. Cut to blue satin sheets, and they're doing it. This is all in, basically, we see this happening as Claudius is narrating it. There's no dramatization whatsoever. It's just like a narrated puppet show.
Yeah, and I assume that's partly because we kind of already saw this last episode with, what was it, Silius, the guy from Yes.
Appius Silanus was the last guy.
Now this is Gaius Silius,
who is the object of her affection.
She loves people whose name starts with Sil. Silanus, Silius, Scylla the prostitute. Just that's her deal. But yeah, it's all like, it's almost, you almost expect Claudius to be like, yada yada, you know how this goes. I eventually found out. Okay, where did I leave off? Hold on. Where does this pick up again?
Yeah, there is a lot of retreading going on in this story as she now sets her hooks into this other older, handsome man who she wants to hug and kiss all the time. But Claudius doesn't care because he's still like, what is Herod up to? Cut back to the inner cardboard chamber. Marcus comes back from his Messiah research and basically tells Claudius the story of Christmas.
Yep.
What exactly is this Messiah?
A king, Caesar, who is to come and redeem Israel of all its sins. Philo, their greatest living scholar, has declared that he must be descended from King David and born in a village called... What? Bethlehem.
About 43 years ago, it is said that the Messiah was born in a town called, what was it again? Has to have someone come in and whisper it to him. Ah, yes, Bethlehem. And then he died.
Did they say Bethlehem
ago.
Or Bethlehem?
Bethlehem.
They pronounce it in some weird way.
I thought they pronounced it.
Maybe they say Bethlehem.
Yeah. That throws Claudius a little bit for a loop because it turns out Herod was born in Bethlehem. But at the same time, the Messiah supposedly was to have died 15 years ago, according to Thrasyllus's prophecy. And therefore Herod can't be the Messiah. But Marcus goes on to say, but there is a guy, I don't know whether this has anything to do with anything, but he was born in Bethlehem. His name is Joshua Bar Joseph. Some people call him Jesus. He had a bunch of followers and then was crucified 15 years ago. Do you think there's a connection? I don't know. But in any case, Claudius is like, okay, I get it. Herod truly does think that he's the Messiah, and he is really going to make war on us. My friend has become my enemy. He finally figures this out. Cut to the new palace. Messalina's mom is like, why are you taking down that marble head that your husband Claudius gave you? She's like, well, because I'm going to give it to my new boyfriend, Gaius Silius. And Messalina, by the way, when she enters into the scene, you may have noticed she's in full Sith garb at this point. It's one of this dark navy blue cloak with a hood up.
Yeah, well, she's gone. I think she's hoping nobody notices that it's her stealing her own things to give to her boyfriend.
Yeah, and Messalina's mom's like, you've emptied out your house of all of the most expensive furniture that your husband gave you, and you're heaping it onto this dude who's still married, and everyone knows you're putting yourself in danger. And Messaline is like, I do not care anymore.
She says, it's okay, and I'm going to make him divorce his wife anyway.
Oh, right.
And Claudius is, in voiceover, going to tell us everybody knew but me. Even the slaves were laughing at me. They laugh at me still about this. Like, he's full on right. Eeyore at this point.
Yeah. I know. And the thing of it is, like, one of the notes that I made when he entered the Senate was, you know, when he was initially announced by the Praetorian Guard as the new emperor, the Senate laughed at him. And now, as he returned from conquering Rome, the Senate salutes him and applauds him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, part of the reason is that we discussed it a little bit at the end of the last episode, part of the reason that he became so susceptible to manipulation by Messalina is people weren't laughing at him anymore. And his guard was down. He began to feel that he was adored.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, legitimately adored by the Senate and legitimately adored by his own wife. And now, as we cut to him sitting in darkness alone a little bit, you know, years later, thinking back on this, he's drunk and sulky and Eeyore-y, and he's very sad about it because he realized that they were all laughing at him even still. Even at the height of his adoration, he was being laughed at behind his back.
Yeah, poor
Boo,
Claudius.
Poor Claudius. That's what, you know what? We called it poor Claudius. Cut back to the present day. Marcus is back again. Boy, this episode is moving fast. So we just learned two scenes ago that Herod Agrippa, a character that we have followed since episode 2, if not sooner.
When he was a creepy little boy.
When he was a precocious little child's play doll.
When he is kind of like, Claudius is talking my buddy. Like, yeah. they're like, Claudius needs a playmate. Well, let's bring this princeling from the East.
And he was a founding member of the Claude Squad. James Faulkner, one of the, you know, gave this incredibly charismatic performance. Every time he came into the show, you know, your eyes gravitated to him because
have we made the point that Herod is the Lando of this show? He's like,
oh yeah,
he's the good friend, super charismatic, super into blue capes,
right?
And but he's got to betray his friend for reasons of his own.
Right.
But he's like. Just like I was watching, not to say this making it sound like I'm always ingesting media with my son, which I am. But he was seeing Empire Strikes Back for the first time, and I was like, I forgot you cannot take your eyes off Billy Dee Williams anytime he's on camera.
Yeah.
In that movie.
Oh, like, I've got supply problems of every kind.
And he's sharing the screen with a giant bear man,
yeah, right.
Who is adorable and has a robot strapped to his back, and like these kind of like space samurai.
Yeah.
And you're still like, oh, I just want to see more Billy Dee Williams as Lando.
Yeah. Or Donald Glover as Lando. Also
or Donald Glover as Lando. Also great. I mean, Lando is a great character, and they've picked two really charismatic guys to play him.
For all of the occasional sort of forays into Jewish stereotype that Herod Agrippa occasionally was guilty of, in general, James Faulkner's performance as Herod was electric, and you loved the fact that he genuinely loved Claudius.
Yes. I find myself usually pretty attuned to being Jewish, to Jewish stereotypes, and it like just as even though there are a few that he falls into, and of course there are other characters. There's that landlord who is like just a straight on Jewish stereotype,
right?
But there is something like empowering, because you don't see it that often, of one of the most charismatic and sympathetic and like sexy characters legitimately in the show is the Jewish guy,
yeah,
which is really great.
And you know, he's such a key figure in Claudius's life that, of course, it's devastating when he gets this intelligence from the eastern provinces that his friend has betrayed him and is now thinks that he's the Messiah and he's going to march against him. And that was two scenes ago that we learned that. And now Marcus walks in to Claudius and goes, hey, guess what? Problem solved. He died. Herod's dead all of a sudden. Herod is dead. He was going to announce himself as the Messiah in front of all the assembled kings of the East.
He had a big stadium show about to put on.
Yeah.
He was wearing a royal robe of silver tissue that flashed in the sun so brightly that it tired the eyes to look at it. The whole audience shouted, O king, live forever. But this was not enough for the men of Tyre and Sidon. They groveled at his feet and said, we repent of our ingratitude. We see now that you are superior to mortal nature. Tyre and Sidon, he replied, you are forgiven. And they answered, it is the voice of God.
He was wearing a robe of metallic silver. It hurt the eye to look upon. But an owl flew in, hooted five times, and then he's like, I feel sick. And then he died 5 days later.
Died a mass of sores.
Right.
And this is all in the book, this is dramatized a little bit more, but it's really like one of those things where like the show and the story is hamstrung by history, because ideally this story would reach a point where Claudius is betrayed by his wife who he thinks loves him, betrayed by his friend who did love him, and he's got to deal with both of these things at the same time. But then history was like, I think I'm going to kill Herod off. So you're not going to get the big climax that you want. And so it's a little anticlimactic. And one of the reasons that the second book, Claudius the God, is just not as satisfying.
Because he dies before he can, before he becomes God.
Yes.
That's not what happened in history.
No, yeah, I mean, but that Claudius and Herod, they never really even get to interact with each other again. You know, it's just like, oh, my best friend went off. He's betraying me. He's dead now. Oh, well, what would have been cool if I could have talked to him at any of those points?
I know. I appreciate that's the given history or the history that we accept.
Yeah.
I also appreciate that it's like, yeah, Herbert Wise and Jack Pullman only have one episode to cover all this territory. So, you know, all of a sudden, yeah, it just happens that he's dead. I also appreciate that they did the best they could in their own weird way to make this scene interesting, because while the death of Herod Agrippa obviously takes Derek Jacobi as Claudius by desperate surprise, and he's very sad and upset about it, there is something extremely comical as Marcus continues to tell the story with this huge grin on his face. Like, he is not reading the room at all. He's like, and then what happened was he put on a silver robe and it hurt the eyes to look upon it. And everyone was this is like, dude, this is upsetting news to Claudius. I mean, it's good news, I guess, for Rome, but bad news for your emperor. Take a moment and chill.
Yeah.
The thing, and maybe you can help me understand this, because most of the time when the characters are referring to something happening off stage or something supernatural or weird happening or something that they don't quite understand the reason for, we, with the benefit of hindsight and history, know, oh, that's what they're talking about. So, you know, when Caligula first said to Livia, the Jews have prophesied that there will rise soon a Messiah who will take the place of all of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be me. And we're like, oh, I get why Caligula thought that was going to be him. But what they're talking about, of course, is the prophecy of Jesus. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when what's his name? Marcus says there happens to be a guy named Joshua, a native of Galilee. Maybe this is the guy we're thinking of, but probably he's just a cult leader. I mean, literally, it's like he founded a cult.
He's like, there's always cults.
Yeah. And we're like, we know that's going to be historically accurate philosopher teacher becomes the center of a massive worldwide religion, and they don't know that, ha ha ha. But when Marcus describes what happened to Herod, that he was about to announce his messiahdom, and then an owl landed and hooted five times, and Claudius is like, yeah, I get it. He hated owls. That makes sense. And then he immediately took ill and then died 5 days later. This is one where I'm like, what happened? Like, what? I know that Claudius thinks that the owl was a bad portent for Herod. And I know that mm-hmm. Herod thinks that he died because he usurped the one true God by threatening to proclaim himself God. But what really happened in this case? Did he have gout? Did he have a seizure? Did he have a heart attack? What happened?
I think it is not. It's, you know, it's not clear. This is information that I'm surprised we didn't hear before in the show, is that apparently there was a time when Herod was imprisoned by Tiberius and saw an owl, and it says here, this is according to Wikipedia, the owl is interpreted as saying, you're going to get out and you're going to become king someday, but if you see an owl again, you're going to die. So when he saw that owl, he immediately was like, oh, I went too far. Uh-oh. And according to the historians of the time, this is what happened. And according to, and I think they would have thought people would know about it, because it's talked about in Acts, in the book of Acts.
Yes.
They describe this where the translation here is
now Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, him in a body. And after winning over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they asked for a reconciliation because the country depended upon the king's country for food. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took his seat on the platform, and delivered a public address to them. The people kept shouting, "The voice of God and not a mortal." And immediately, because he had not given the glory of God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died.
And this is presented in Acts as being partly for his hubris and also partly because he's been martyring apostles up to this point. In order to clear this, he's like, Jesus isn't the Messiah. I'm the Messiah. I got to kill some of these apostles that are left over.
Did you like the fact that I was able to quote the book of Acts from memory?
I was just amazed that suddenly spread. It was like Claudius just dropping a homer on us. You're able to do it so well.
I had forgotten that I memorized the book of Acts. It's the only book of the Bible I ever memorized, too. I was like, oh, right. I know this.
But I imagine there was probably some sickness or something. But, you know, all these stories are from thousands of years ago. And especially once it gets into the Bible, it's hard to tell, you know, how true anything is about it.
Once it gets into the Bible, it's absolute truth. We know that for sure.
I guess so.
It says here on Wikipedia, I don't know why I have this page open. It's not that I was reading from Acts of the Wikipedia page about Herod Agrippa. But there's this one line, maybe we need to, maybe we'll have to talk about this with Mike Duncan if we get a chance to talk to him. It says here, the Jewish Encyclopedia speculated that Agrippa's, quote, sudden death at the games in Caesarea 44 must be considered as a stroke of Roman politics. I wonder what that means. Does that to suggest that he was sort of struck down by a Roman secret agent?
Possibly. Or, you know, or poisoned, possibly.
Yeah, by a Roman secret agent.
By a Roman secret agent. Right. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be outside
the realm
of
possibility. I would call it a Roman 007, but they didn't have a zero.
No. Well, yeah, that's true. Just Roman VII. It was just seven. So another reason Roman numerals are dumb, not having a zero.
Yeah. Thanks, Arabic numerals, for introducing the concept of zero. Appreciate that.
But it's a good question. I would have to do more. And I think I will do more research off the pod just to find out. But certainly Herod took it as, I've offended God.
Yes. And this wonderful performance of James Faulkner's is now reduced to yet another voiceover as Claudius reads the letter that Herod sent him, saying, "Marmoset, I am dying. Forgive me. I've offended against the only living God. Also, my body is full of maggots, so forgive me. Oh, and also, again, I know I said earlier, but I'll say it again. Trust no one. You hear me? No one." End quote. That's pretty much a quote of the letter.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
And Claudius is very sad. Let's take a little break. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast fan. We have a quick favor to ask. We'd like to get a better idea of who you are and what you care about. So if you have a couple moments to spare, go to MaximumFun.org/ad survey. There, we've got a short, anonymous survey that won't take any more than 10 minutes to fill out. Plus, if you finish it, you'll get a 10% discount on our merch at the MaxFun store. MaxFun shows have always relied on support from our members and always will. The survey will help keep the few ads we do run relevant and interesting for you. Again, that's MaximumFun.org/ad survey, all one word. And thanks for your help.
All right, we're back with iPodius, and we are.
I mean, we're back with iClaudius too.
Yeah, we're back with iPodius. We're back with iClaudius. We're back with old man Claudius, who is now saying, "For the first time in my life, I was alone." And that's true. The whole Claude Squad's gone now. Yeah. All of his friends: Germanicus, Postumus, Agrippina, Herod. Who else did he like? That's about it, right? Antonia, a little bit.
Who was it? Who was the kid with the cough?
Gemellus?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't hate each other.
He was never part of the pod squad. He was never part of the Claude squad.
I feel like he could have been like a Claude squad in training. He'd be like every superhero team has like the jokey sidekick that nobody really likes.
As much as I enjoyed Douglas Melbourne's performance as coughing Gemellus, no way he would have ever been in the Claude squad. How dare you? But in any case, Claude squad's all dead except for him.
And Claudius has just been told via letter, remember, trust no one. And then Messalina's like, hey, can I use your royal signet seal? Yeah. He's like, of course you can, my love.
So annoying. And he also, he's like, I've got no one but Messalina, so I gave her all the power. And guess what? I started working on my book. So now we're starting to come full circle to the moment that opened this, where he sat down to start writing his book. But meanwhile, we cut to Gaius Silius, Messalina's new boy toy, and Messalina and her boobs, because there's a lot of nudity in this scene.
Wouldn't you rather be my wife than my mistress?
Your wife? Oh, Gaius. More than anything in the world. But how?
Divorce is simple enough. You just send your freedman to your husband's house and you tell him.
This is the most nude episode, I would say. Wouldn't you say? There's a ton of...
It's the most concentrated nudity. There would be like fleeting glimpses in other episodes. But in this one, it's just like, yeah, when people have sex, they take all their clothes off. I'm sorry. Was that news to you, Britain of 1976? Because I, Herbert Wise, take off all my clothes when I have sex. Maybe you should try it sometime. I'm Herbert Wise for sex.
You may or may not know that I filmed a nude scene for an episode of Mozart in the Jungle. It's all recounted
I would
in
know.
My...
because I read it in your book, Medallion Status, on shelves now, right. And also the internet.
Right. No one knows from actually watching that episode. I think because when that episode aired, they were like, what can I do to make myself forget the image of John Hodgman in the nude? They did what it took. They took whatever drugs they could to forget. But I did write about it in my book, Medallion Status, available on shelves, as Elliot likes to point out.
Mm-hmm.
And, look, I am not a particularly seasoned or trained actor, but I was excited to do a nude scene. I was wearing a privacy garment, as they say, to cover up the most private parts that you weren't going to see. But, you know, it was an exciting and challenging and hard thing to do. And Sheila White, the actor who plays Messalina, was nude in a lot, like completely nude in a lot of this episode. And she just kills her performance without any self-consciousness whatsoever. It's fantastic. Good job. But in any case, now they're hanging around. And also Gaius Silius is kind of nude in this as well. And he wants Messalina to divorce the emperor because he already got divorced to be with her. And he's like, why don't you divorce the emperor and then marry me? And she's like, what? No. Why? I have everything. We made a long-term plan specifically, which is that I get to fuck you whenever I want, but I still get to be the queen of Rome. And he's like, no. So this is like, no, I've got a different long-term plan. If you divorce the emperor, everyone in Rome is going to be like, oh, we like her the best. They'll get rid of him and we'll restore the republic. Sounds like a plan?
This is a crazy plan.
right. By everyone in Rome supposedly knows that she has been cheating on Claudius, the emperor, for years. And it is known to everyone except for Claudius. And Silius's idea is that if she were to divorce the emperor of Rome and marry this dude that she's been... marry her side piece, that Rome will all be like, hooray for our new queen, Messalina. Boo, Claudius. Get out of here.
And it's like, do you guys not remember the last emperor made a horse part of the government and ate a baby? And the people of Rome were like, yeah, emperor, yeah, does what he wants, yeah, sure.
That's what an emperor does.
Those are shows of strength. Look, I don't like everything he does, but I like that he's strong. So it's a bad plan.
And even if that part were true, it wouldn't even be like, and then they'll make you the empress or anything. It's like, then we'll restore the republic. It's like, I don't know if that sounds like a good plan, but Messalina's like, all right, fine. Let's do it tomorrow. When Claudius goes to Ostia to inspect the winter harbor that's finally been constructed there. It was a big plot point of the last episode.
Yeah, the corn factors are still smarting over it.
Yeah. And, when he's away, I'll say I have a headache. And instead, I'll send a letter to the palace saying you're divorced. And then and then we'll get married that same day and take over Rome. Snap. Just like that. And so, Claudius ends up paying for the fact that he was really interested in building a winter harbor to lower those corn prices, because that's exactly what happens. Cut to Pallas and Narcissus on the inner cardboard chamber. Narcissus pulls over an enormous chair.
It is the Imperial Palace. They only have so many modest chairs.
Narcissus is like, he's saying to Pallas, now we have to tell him. Like,
Come on.
He just got a letter. The palace just got a letter saying that he was divorced. His wife is now marrying Gaius Silius. And he's going to look weak and ineffectual. And they're going to take over Rome. Claudius will look too old and corrupt to be leader. And this is essentially an invitation to the Senate to restore the Republic. And I'm like, yeah, dude, we just heard that in the nude scene.
We heard it. But do you think we were distracted by the nudity and we didn't take in the information? Like, why does it need to be repeated? It would have been worth it if Narcissus had said, like, I've heard of a military coup, but a marital coup? And then just looked at the camera.
Yeah, there weren't enough camera takes in this set, in this whole series, frankly. You know, now that Herbert Wise is getting funky with the wolf's heads and the camera angles, he might have, you know, done a few cam turns just for fun.
Thrown some Jim from The Office moments in there.
Yeah, you might wonder how I found myself here. Finally, Pallas is like, all right, fine, we'll tell him. But we have to, he cannot be allowed to see Messalina, because Messalina, whatever she does, she will be able to talk him into thinking she's the greatest.
She's got him wrapped around her finger, but does she have to let him linger? That's the question.
Right. Rest in peace, Dolores or Reardon. But of course, neither Narcissus nor Pallas want to be the one to tell him. Who will he believe? Snap of the finger, I got it. Calpurnia.
She has just married Gaius Silius. And the wedding party is still going on in Rome.
Are you mad? Or wicked, or both?
They're married. Your wife and Silius, everyone in Rome knows.
But I've left her in bed with a headache.
And now she's in bed with Silius.
Remember Calpurnia?
Mm-hmm.
The member of the Guild of Prostitutes, who was Claudius's companion, presumably lover, clearly friend, and roommate, during the happiest time of his life, when he was out of politics after Caligula had kicked him out of the consulship and was just living the small town life happily and bookishly, avoiding all of the imperial intrigue that he had hated his whole life, until the moment he saw Messalina and was like, fuck it, I'm going to marry this person. And become emperor, and only think about Calpurnia again to occasionally visit with her in bed. And now all of a sudden it falls to Calpurnia to be the one to say, I told you so.
Mm-hmm.
Joe,
if this was a romantic comedy, this would be when Claudius is like, oh, I was so blind, I should have married you, my best friend Calpurnia.
Nope, never did.
No. This is hard for her to tell him. Like, she breaks down. There's no sense of like, oh, now I finally get to show you I was right. She really, like, this is hard news for her to break, because she knows it's going to hurt her friend, which shows what a great friend she is.
Joe Rowbottom is the greatest.
Yeah.
She performs this character there's a real human being that you believe has a true affection for Claudius. And Calpurnia is the greatest too. And now Claudius knows this. And Pallas explains that your wife had a sex competition. Sorry, I didn't tell you over the past 3 years.
Maybe you wondered what that trophy was that your wife put on the mantle that showed two people having sex.
Oh, right. Well, guess what? It's not on the mantle anymore, because she's given it and all of your belongings to Gaius Silius. You didn't notice. And now they are married, and you're divorced, by the way. And they are about to restore the Republic. Act now, or she and her husband control Rome, is what he says. And there's this moment where Claudia sits down, and you can tell. I mean, like, for all of our making fun of it, Silius's and Messalina's plan was pretty good. Like, it's going to work. And Claudius realizes it's going to work, and he's like, am I emperor anymore? And they're like, well, they've turned some of the guard against you, but we think the most of the guard is still with you, but we're not sure. And if you want to make sure that you're still emperor and the Republic does not happen, you have to act now. And he takes a moment to think about it. And there's a moment, I think, that where it crosses Derek Jacobi's actorly face, where you're supposed to think like, yeah, you know what? Maybe this is what should happen. I've always wanted to have a republic. I never wanted to do this. But then, of course, his anger and his frustration at being cuckolded asserts itself. And he goes, no, go get them. Let's go get them. Arrest them all.
I think it's the anger of being cuckolded and the realization that Messalina is another Livia and another Livilla, and that it's both anger and also like, no, she's a monster. Okay, forget about it.
No,
it's mostly a personal spite?
I obviously he feels wronged and he feels foolish, and he is wronged and he is foolish. I think that he has gotten used to being emperor. I mean, the fact that he even asked, am I still emperor, was a question that was more like desperation as opposed to, great, now I don't have to be emperor anymore. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like you're supposed to get in this moment is this moment where he's weighing, like, I could wash my hands of this and be in these three rooms with the woman who truly cares about me, or I can become exactly what I feared all emperors are destined to become, you know, bloodthirsty tyrants.
Mm-hmm.
And when he says, arrest them all, I mean, to me, it was, you know, a tragic choice that he made. Even though I'm on his side, you know, but
yeah,
still.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the moment at the end of The Godfather when Diane Keaton is seeing Al Pacino through the door as it closes, and she realizes, like, oh, no, what he does is bad. Hold on a second. Like Claudius realizing that about himself almost in a way.
Right. And what happens.
I can see that now. You convinced me.
Yeah. What happens next in this episode sets up for what will happen in the final episode, in which, if my memory serves and I don't remember it very well, Claudius enters a period of essential nihilism. Like all ideals are gone by the time the next episode comes around. And that's the kind of the sad part. But,
so it's a lot like the last episode of Family Ties.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What happened in the last episode of Family Ties?
Oh, I think they realized the essential emptiness of human relationships because those closest to you will always disappoint you and they just disband as a family. I don't remember the episode that well. I remember them all giving a curtain call at the end.
Does that have any bearing on what actually happened in the series finale of Family Ties?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I would love if I stopped watching that show after a period of time. So if you had told me, Elise and what's the guy's name?
Michael Gross. Right.
Michael Gross and was it Meredith Baxter Burney? Was the mom?
I think so.
If you had told me that the mom and dad in Family Ties, in the final episode, they get a divorce.
That would be so sad.
He quits his job at PBS because he realizes, you know what? There's no fighting the Reagan era. We're, you know, my Michael J. Fox, my conservative son, is correct. I'm moving into the woods and I'm leaving my family.
And Michael J. Fox sings, "The future belongs to me," as the camera just kind of pans away.
That I would have bought it. That would have been powerful television. But in the meantime,
no, I think it probably ends with them hugging.
Yeah. In the meantime, Claudius has become exactly what he feared. He has become exactly what he hated, which is in many ways our all of our destinies. And with that thought, let's take a little break and we'll be right back. Hey, everybody. This is just a reminder that all these episodes of iPodius have been pre-recorded, including all the letters. So when you send me letters at Hodgman@MaximumFun.org, I enjoy them. The world cannot, unless you want to post or repost them at the Maximum Fun subreddit on the Reddit website. The Maximum Fun subreddit is a subreddit on Reddit where people talk about Maximum Fun shows, including iPodius. And I've been using it a lot, getting in there and answering people's questions and saying thank you for their comments. It's a really fun community, and we're doing a lot of iPodius talk over there. So if you have memories of watching iClaudius in Latin class, or in a weird moment with your mom or dad when you were a kid, just think to maybe go over there if you want. reddit.com/r/maximumfun. That's reddit.com/r/maximumfun. Look for the Judge John Hodgman discussions. Look for the Flophouse discussions. Look for the iPodius discussions. And discuss. Thanks.
I mean, you get such a dose, there's such a menu of the depravity of human character, and also how they use religion. You know, at that time, Rome was, they were very religious, although their religions were pagan. They knew that the people, the actual public, was very religious, and so they kind of co-opted religion to suit their purposes, kind of like what the Republicans have done in America right now. You know, they prayed to the gods, and it was a very public display. You had to sacrifice to the gods, you had to pray to the gods to show that you were religious, and also was a part of your patriotism. They were expected to be super, super patriotic. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do not.
All right. That was Jordan Cowling, our producer, and her mom, Avis, as always, the greatest. We're back now with iPodius talking about iClaudius. Cut. Now to the wedding party of wine-soaked gods. Now, the sex competition I was referring to as Fuckfest 2, which was wrong because it was a sex competition. But this is truly Fuckfest 2. This is the grand inheritor Fuckfest of the previous orgy scene. We have lots of people in that outdoor new palace just hugging and kissing and wearing, satyr, like, you know, goat horns on their head. And
yeah, there's a guy dressed as Pan. The rest of them have ivy leaves, you know, wrapped around them.
Yeah, they're all dressed in their midsummer flowers. They're munching on grapes and just doing it with each other. They're all drunk and stoned out of their minds. Menester is up on a wall wearing a crazy mask.
It is very much, I feel like, an adolescence idea of what a grown-up party is like.
Yeah, I know. That's what when I saw this with my parents, I'm like, can this be my next birthday party?
And they dance for a while. It feels like they broke into that Caliga's old stash of magic elixir.
Right. The Drusilla potion. Right.
Yeah, and they're just loving life. This is the highest they're ever gonna get. And they're also high on having taken over the government, so they think.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I'm thinking about. It's like, do you really think even though Pallas and Narcissus took this coup very seriously, once and seemed to believe that if Claudius does not arrest and kill them all right away, he will lose control of the government. Once they smash cut to this wacky sex party, I'm not so sure Rome is going to go for this.
Claudius should have just strolled in and be like, never mind. You know what? Yeah. I'll just go back to my throne.
Right.
But I think it's, and I wonder if that's, there's this feeling throughout the series of degradation that like the quality of Rome and Romans is degrading from the height that we saw at the beginning. And so like the quality of schemes and schemers has degraded. So like Livilla was not quite up to Livia's standard, and Messalina is like Livia is the master plotter and she gets what she wants.
Right.
Livilla, her plan to get Tiberius gets pretty far, but they're found out. But then Messalina, it's just like, I got distracted by my drunken party. Hold on, what were we doing?
Yeah, she's brought into the party, born on the arms of Gaius Silius, basically about to pass out. She wakes up enough to say, "Oh, Menester, you're up on the wall there. What do you see?" And he says, "I see a cloud in the shape of Claudius over Ostia." And she goes, "Oh, is he coming this way?" He said, "No, he just farted himself off to sea." And I'm like, yep, doctor's orders. That's what Dr. Xenophon farts a lot suggested. But then what does Minister see? Not a cloud, but Roman guards. What do you call
guards.
Them? Praetorian guards?
Praetorian guards. And they're on their way.
They're on their way to arrest everybody. And they are like, and they all run. Because it turns out that Claudius is not.
It turns out this is a high school party. And as soon as the cops are showing up, everyone jumps over the fence.
That is basically what it's like. I forgot. That's absolutely true. It's a post-prom party that is broken up by angry Claudius. The party broken up, we cut to the outer cardboard chamber in the palace. A guard reports to Pallas, not the palace, but the character Pallas. that they've taken Gaius Silius. Messalina has escaped somehow, but Pallas said under no circumstances is she allowed to see the emperor. And then right away she storms in, and Narcissus, who, you know, between these two sort of Laurel and Hardy servant characters, Pallas and Narcissus.
Mm-hmm.
Narcissus was always, I think, kind of the beta. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pallas was always in charge. Narcissus was like, I'll go along with it. But now Narcissus, I was amazed by how fucking mad Narcissus was to Messalina.
She is the emperor's wife and the mother of his children.
But is he the father? Who knows whose litter they are?
Well, Pallas is very much the alpha between the two, but he's also kind of in it for himself. Narcissus, as the show goes on, you get the feeling like, oh, he really does serve Claudius.
Right.
Like, he does serve the emperor. So when that Messalina pulled this shit, Pallas is like, another enemy we got to get rid of. And Narcissus is like, how dare you?
Yeah. When she goes to him, like, how dare you stand between me and my husband, you Greek? That's because Narcissus is Greek. And Narcissus is like, which husband? He's so mad. You know, he really gets mad. I really love how mad he gets. And they send her away, and everyone's been arrested. In the inner cardboard chamber, Claudius is drunk off his mind. He's so sad. He's like, what would have driven that poor woman to do all these things, like cheat on me for 2 years? She must have been so sad to try to steal the Roman state from me. And Pallas gets him to sign many a death warrant, including Messalina's own. And then he kind of puts his head down on his desk like it's a fourth grade nap time and falls asleep. But Messalina's not done yet. Cut to the new palace. She sends a secret letter. She pens a secret letter to Claudius and sends it to Claudius with their children. So she sends their son and daughter off to go see Claudius and bear this secret letter. And Messalina's mother's all
like, they really are divorced parents, because she's like, I'll communicate with Claudius through a letter that my children bring to him during visitation times.
And Messalina's mom comes in. She's like, how could you do this, child? As though Messalina's mom wasn't part of it all along. And then there's a knock, and Messalina's like, Claudius has finally come to see me, and I can spin this. I'm not done yet. But she's done, because it's a Praetorian guard come to take her life. He is to offer her the dagger first so that she can take her own life, which was Pallas, not the building, but the character's suggestion. Because if she takes her own life, they won't have to show Claudius the death warrant that he signed. It'll just be that she's committed suicide out of her own guilt.
Mm-hmm.
But, and even her mom's like, you should do this. You should take your own life with this rubber dagger. But what does Messalina do? She pulls a Piso. Can't do it.
At the time, that was known as pulling a Piso. Yeah.
And they're like, we're going to cut off your head. She said, please don't cut off my head. And then they cut off her head.
And this is another kind of experimental camera move. She's screaming. She's saying, not my head, not my head. And in close up, and the guard has his sword, and as he swipes it and it almost hits her neck, the camera swish pans Malcolm in the Middle or Family Guy style to the next scene. And there's something, I see what they're going for with it, but it's like kind of jokey.
Well, the camera whip pans along with the motion of the sword. You don't see it cut her head, but then you go immediately from her screaming to birds chirping.
Yeah.
To bird song, which was, I liked it. I thought it was effective and chilling.
Oh, I think Herbert Wise had no way of knowing that 30, 40 years later, that in my mind, this would become synonymous with, okay, we're going to cut away to a gag that refers to something that the person just said, and then we're going to cut right back again.
Right.
Which is, it does on so many shows now. So it was just funny to see, like, oh, that was probably a very effective chilling moment in 1976. But to me, it was like, that it was going to be like, whoop, and then cut to, like, something that Messalina is saying later on, like, oh boy, that was a mistake, and then whoop, back to her head rolling away.
Yeah, same deal as how in the last episode, in the assassination of Caligula episode, Hail Who, Cassius and all the other conspirators sitting in that tavern, and it's just camera pan from one to the other to the other to the other, would eventually become a motif in that 70s show when Ashton Kutcher and Topher Grace are getting high. Like, they didn't know what they were inventing at that time.
It's true. They didn't know that they're making it possible.
We cut now to Birdsong and Claudius sitting in the outer cardboard chamber, bereft, hungover, and asking to see Messalina because he doesn't even know. He doesn't even remember that he signed her own death warrant, and it falls to Pallas Narcissus to show it to him. And he is silent and he absorbs what has happened. And then it is revealed, Pallas says, oh, by the way, some other news. You've been made a god in Colchester. In England, which he just conquered, the temple that was going to be dedicated to Augustus, the Britons were not interested in that because Augustus means nothing to them. And instead, they are willing to worship Claudius. So even though Claudius was not able to give his consent to this, the local official on the ground did it because he believed it to be politically correct. And again, that I don't know whether that's the first use of that term, but it really struck me there. But of course, that's not the important part. The important part is that Claudius has become exactly what he fought and stood against his entire life. He has become emperor. He has become a deluded dummy, tricked by power, and now worshipped as a god. And the scene ends with him sobbing silently directly into the camera.
Oh, it's so sad. It's like, yeah, no matter, he tried so hard to be a good emperor, and he ended up turning into a bad emperor. Like, turning up into just an emperor, that there is no good emperor. There's no such thing. And it's just like, I felt so...
You know, look. He made some mistakes. He trusted the wrong people.
Well, that I think
to be fair, he was building some dope harbors.
No, that's true. But any political structure that's based around one man and the people closest to them using his power as their own power is doomed to corruption at some point. You know,
no matter how many
great corn ports you build.
Yeah, I mean, the corruption, I think, is not so much like, how can I get as much money for myself? Or how can I get as much power for myself, right? That kind of low-level corruption of, like, grifting and skimming and you know, stealing and lining your own pockets, that kind of corruption is one thing. But I think the corruption of absolute power, which is what we're talking about here,
yeah,
is the sole corruption of believing that you deserve it. Like, that's what we were talking about last time, was that Claudius, on some level, even though he had opposed the very idea of imperial government, once he becomes emperor, he's like, yeah, but I'm going to do it right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess I deserve to be emperor.
And that he's seen his friend Herod, who was a good man and a trustworthy man, become corrupted with the idea like, oh, I'm probably the Messiah.
Yeah, I'm probably God. Do you know what I mean? And I think that is something that people, and especially men, who get into positions of power that approximate absolute power, and I'm talking about CEOs and billionaires, they do get the idea in their head, like, I'm the only one who can fix this. You know, I'm the only one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one who has been chosen by providence, not by fluke of my birth or by inherited wealth or a couple of good business decisions or an incredibly good turn in the stock market. Somehow I have been touched by some other power to have as much power, and I deserve as much power as I have, and I deserve to execute it with my own discretion, and I don't have to listen to anybody else. And I'm talking about Michael Bloomberg. Like, that guy scares the hell out of me. And I'm not talking about Donald Trump so much here. I mean, obviously Donald Trump does not know how to adjust from being the CEO and sole authority in a privately held company accountable to no shareholders that ran entirely on his whim since the day his father died, right? He does not know how to adapt that kind of power to the elected power of the presidency. And I actually feel like his prime motive... He's always felt like he was the smartest person in the room, and his prime motive is, yeah, I should take everything I want for myself because I'm the one who deserves it, because, and B, I've got this hole in my soul that I can never fill, so I'm trying to fill it with, like, gold shit and praise. You know what I mean?
I mean, Donald Trump's entire life is, what does it take to get my dad to love me? I guess I have to bend the world and get everything and have everyone else tell me how much they love me because my dad never told me.
Right.
That's his, he is like, it's one of the things where I remember at times I'll read articles that describe him as like a Shakespearean character, and I'm like, not really. Like, he's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And when Donald Trump literally said, I alone can fix it, I don't think that he believed that for a second. Like, I don't think that he has that kind of power/God complex that he thought that he could actually fix the United States.
I think his life is desperately trying to convince everyone and himself that he is good at things, you know.
All right. I think this has gone on long enough.
While you were talking, not that I wasn't giving you my full attention the entire time.
No, but I was looking up, it was boring.
I was looking up the origin of political correctness, the idea of politically correct, and the phrase politically correct goes back at least as far as 1934.
Oh, all right.
So, but at the time it meant, I guess, kind of the same thing, but a little different. Now, politically correct kind of seems to mean what you can say, what you can do without either offending someone or seeming wrong. But at the time, it was used to mean like adhering to a party line very tightly.
Right.
So it says according to Wikipedia that in the 40s and the 50s, it was used by socialists to attack communists, saying that communists just, they're so ideologically tied to what the party line is, they're so politically correct that they are lacking in actual ideals.
And principle. It is an action, as in the case of what Pallas was saying, like, you may have been opposed to the principle of being named a god, but pragmatically on the ground, if we're going to run this new province called Britain, it is the politically correct thing to do is to let them worship you as a god. So,
yeah.
There.
Whereas now that the use seems to be more like, ugh, that's a thing. Like, this is what I have to say, so I don't want to get people mad at me.
Right.
Which is slightly different.
That's one for the history books. Let's wrap up this episode and offer it the dagger before we cut off its head. And tomorrow we shall wake up and be like, what happened to that episode? I miss it. And then we'll cry silently.
As we realize what we've done and what we had to do and were forced to do. Yeah, but the circumstances of history. Sad, really.
Any final thoughts before we go, Elliot? You don't have to have any.
I don't have any, except I would say I can't wait to see what's going to happen to Claudius, except I have a sense it's going to be genuinely tragic in some way.
I don't want to spoil you, but Claudius is no longer alive in the year 2019. So
I was really hoping we could get him on the podcast. Oh no.
Well, we'll find out, because next time we'll be watching and discussing I, Claudius, episode XII, Old King Log, the very last episode. As I mentioned before, I remember very, very little about this episode, except I do know that Brian Blessed comes back in a flashback, so stay tuned. Our producer is Jordan Cowling. Our theme song, Theme from I, Claudius, was performed by Paul F. Tompkins.
Our senior producer, Laura Swisher.
And all of this exists thanks to you, members of MaximumFun.org. For now, goodbye from I, John Hodgman.
And I, Elliot Kalin.
Trust no one. No one. And also, my body is full of maggots. We'll talk more later.
MaximusFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Bethlehem.